Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Just before evening puja, Debbie came and told me that looks like Tina's mom is seriously ill, condition is not so good at all, period. So that's sort of not very good news. But it's also, in terms of Dhamma, and in terms of the reality of, say, the human condition, normal. That which has arisen is passing away. That which came into being is changing. That which is born is dying. And particularly in terms of our being in retreat and being focusing on really trying to make the practice bear as much fruit and as much benefit as possible. This reality is very important to be contemplating. The imminent nature of change, the imminent nature of sickness, the imminent nature of death. These are realities that don't wait for our convenience. It's like this last week helping out with Mechi Sansini and trying to give some assistance to her so that she could benefit people. Giving them, letting people know what she's doing, helping people in the south of Thailand who've been affected by the tsunami. And it's like in the village that she's determined to help. It's originally a couple thousand people, there's only a couple hundred left now. And, of course, lots of suffering everywhere. And wanting to help her. But then, you know, and there's always a sort of the whining, whinging voice that goes in the background, you know. What an inconvenient time to be doing this. It's my retreat. You know, what an inconsiderate time to have a tsunami. I cannot wait till I'm out of retreat. You know, what kind of a whinging, miserable kind of thought is that? But, you know, it's there. you know, why can't the world just sort of conform to my timetable and my schedule? So it's suitable for me, and you know, and that's really, you know, really obvious. But you know, we approach life in that way, and you know, things are, we always measure it from our perspective, our preference, our view, our ideal, and you know, it's and we're always shocked when it doesn't actually do that, and the world doesn't conform that way. We want life to be very consistent, very clear, I don't have time to get sick, I don't have time to get ill. It's not time yet for me to die. And, you know, nobody's ready. Nobody's ever really ready. Because there's always this, you know, something that we need to be doing, something that we need to be planning, hoping for. And so that real embracing and taking on of the reality of impermanence, change, uncertainty, you know, we keep putting it off. You know, I'll really knuckle down and get my practice together and really sort of penetrate that truth of impermanence after I get this and this and this and this done. You know, then I'll really be able to do it. Yeah. This retreat, I'm really going to get it. Doing this. Won't be like last retreat. I wasted my time last retreat. This one, I'm really going to do it. And it's always... It's always put off. It's always shelved. It's always... not really considered and really brought into the present moment. So that's really the necessary kind of motivation for ourselves is how to make this practice a real present moment practice. Really take these truths and contemplate them and really stick with them. Stay with that contemplation so that we allow it to settle in the heart, to penetrate the heart. I don't know, and that's the necessity of mindfulness and awareness, so that the ability of the mind to see clearly is dependent on the degree of awareness and clarity, mindfulness. And of course, that's everything has its conditions. You know, so the condition of being mindful is dependent on virtue and a sense of kind of uprightness and lack of remorse, lack of kind of wavering, and the ability to still the mind and really enter into a quality of stillness and firmness internally, tranquility, so that thus you can, because when the mind is very still and quiet, and then to drop a reflection of one's own mortality and one's fundamental insecurity, or one's death, then it really brings up a strong motivation and a relinquishing, a letting go. So that to attend to those conditions, but also we need to be really bringing it into the present moment. Because there can be that constant tinkering with conditions, trying to get everything right, trying to get the conditions right, trying to get the method down, trying to get the technique, the details, attend to all the details. The details of our spiritual practice are just as endless as the details of our external lives, details of the world. That really bringing attention into the present moment and making that immediate. This is not just a game or an exercise. We don't have endless chances to really penetrate and free ourselves. We carry with us the diagnosis already that we're going to die, and we don't really listen to the diagnosis. We don't. It always comes as a shock when the reality hits. Like my mother, this last week, talking with my mother, she went to the doctors for a checkup. She hadn't had a physical for 2.5 years, so went to have a checkup and in terms of the seemingly consistent, unstoppable forces in the universe, my mother is one of them. and the doctors say, "Oh yeah, everything's looking good. This is your blood work's good. This is good. That's good. Oh, look at your heart. Okay, this is good. That's good. And when do you have your heart attack?" "I've not had a heart attack." "Oh yeah, sure you have. There's this indication that she'd had a heart attack. Didn't even know it. Still doesn't know it." "When was it? Didn't catch." So that you have a heart attack, don't even know that you've had it. This can happen. So they really are taking those contemplations, just the fundamental impermanence of our life. This is the Buddha. These contemplations of impermanence. He gives all sorts of similes as to their efficacy, and I can't remember them all. It's like a farmer when he's plowing, when he plows and it cuts all the little rootlets in the soil to prepare the earth. In the same way, one contemplates impermanence to cut the attachments to desire and letting go of the sense of I am. or like the cutting of a mango, because they grow in clusters, mangoes, and then you cut one little branch, then all of the, probably be like a grapevine, when you cut a grapevine, then of course all the whole cluster comes down, the whole bunch comes down. So then the same way that if you contemplate impermanence and the whole cluster of desire, attachment, delusion of I am, all falls away. And then he gives the images of all the, say, of the, say, of all different flowers that are fragrant. Say, jasmine is the most fragrant, in the same way that the impermanence is the sort of the most efficacious of all different roots that are fragrant. The orris root is fragrant, and in the same way impermanence, in the same way of all woods, what is most fragrant is sandalwood. In the same way that impermanence is the sort of thing, kind of the best. Contemplation, reflection for cutting through. So that because once you start contemplating impermanence deeply, and the implications are a bit more clear, because things are impermanent, then they're really, there's this fundamental uncertainty, sense of not sure, and the fundamental unsatisfactoriness of that, because we'd like things to be really stable. But that really, bringing that home, and not as just a theory, the theory of impermanence, but you start to contemplate what actually is changing, what is impermanent, what is uncertain. Right from beginning, from in this present moment, what is uncertain? I'm sure what's changing. The breath is changing. The very breath that is sustaining our life. The thoughts and feelings, perceptions that make up our whole sense of who we are and what the world is. And this impermanent, changing cluster of impressions that we keep trying to make sense of. And the other night I was talking, and using the image of the stars and sky, how we look up at the sky and see these dots of light in the sky, and then we make images out of them, and we do the same thing with creating a sense of self, of me, as what I said. And as we were driving up that night, Ajahn Sudhanto was saying, "Yeah, well, this is." It's just as we take a very tenuous, two-dimensional sort of kind of scattering of points, and then make it into a whole three-dimensional life-like images. Say of the bear, of the hunter, of the, And of course, the same thing is we don't make just sort of thinking further on. Well, it's not even just three dimensional. These multi-dimensional beings who we create me out of that. Those impressions of just these points of experience of a form, a feeling, a perception, thoughts. Random scattered thoughts, consciousness which is rather selective. Everything's selective. We're constantly selecting these different points of experience, and then coming up with images of our of who we are, and then of course as in these multi-dimensional beings who are complex and sort of embedded in dukkha. But similarly with the sense of the world, we're just constantly creating the world out of our selected experience, random little points of just like in the night sky, these random points that are light years away from each other, and then making images. And we're trying to make sense of it. We're trying to constantly make sense. It's usually pretty arbitrary. And so, and we don't really pay attention to what's driving it in the sense of the, particularly our what we believe in. We believe. So this is what's driving. It's like that sense of that saying. If I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. But in reality, it's the opposite. If I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it. So we go around with these belief systems of who we are, what other people are, what the world is, and we have these beliefs, ideas. And then we find the evidence to support that. And then that's what we see. I'm such and such a personality, I have such and such capabilities, the world is like this, that person's like this, she's always like that, he's like this. And then we form those... We gather the evidence to support that. And it's like they've done experiments with people where you take glasses, spectacles, and put them on. And what it does is invert the image so that you see everything upside down. The mind very quickly. It sees that. All the images are upside down. But then the mind will shift the things around to make it right side up again. Because it doesn't believe that. I don't believe the mind doesn't believe that that's the way the world looks. Even though that's, you say, the data of the way that, say, the optics are working, is that we're seeing it everything upside down. But the mind doesn't believe that, so it doesn't see it that way. It changes it to fit it what it what it believes. It's like that's in the these BBC Reith lectures that on brain science that Tenzin Dento found. The people with and the certain anomalies in their the way that their perceptions function. We say with somebody with a stroke who's has one side of the brain is damaged, and then they're not seeing a side of the body, so that they don't recognize that particular side of the body, and then he's doing an experiment to sort of see how the brain, how it's functioning, what's working, what's not, and then there's things that you're seeing where showing through a mirror, he has an assistant on one side, so they can't see visually they can't see this side of the body, so that he has an assistant holding a pencil. And he holds a mirror on this side, and then saying, "You know, can you get the mirror? Or can you get can you touch that pencil?" And the brain doesn't figure it out that it's going to the mirror. It's like it's in the mirror, the pencil, rather than on here. And this is something that he said that like a. I said even a chimpanzee could figure it out, but there's this sort of anomaly of the brain. It's just sort of, because it's in the image, and they're not accepting the fact that this particular side of the body is existing. And it's to them it's obvious that it's in the actual image. And you know, on a certain level, again, it's sort of this belief. Is the underlying, because the image is like that. That's where it is. The logic doesn't take it to sort of say, well, actually, that the person is over there. So we're constructing our world. Usually through flawed. And incomplete information, and then we don't really question what are we believing in. So similarly, there's experiments in Yale. They did experiments where they'd have people walk down a corridor, and they would say, and they'd ask people to stop when they saw this light flash. And, and they never ever put a light on. And that over 50% of the people would stop at some point along the way because they're convinced that they saw a light flash. So that there's, because they're waiting for the light to flash, then they created the light flashing, they saw it. Another experiment where they did, where they built this really impressive looking machine that when you turned it on and it things whirred and lights went on and monitors were doing this and doing that, and it was supposed to be simulating different sensory stimuli, the things, say, smells or something was supposed to happen. They were supposed to hear something, or they were supposed to smell something, or it would be creating some effect. But when in actual fact, all it did was whir and lights go on, it didn't actually do anything. But whatever they said was to let them know when they experience this smell, or when they experience this sound, or when they experience this particular effect. Over 90% experience something, but the machine was impressive. It's an impressive world we live in, and we create impressive illusions of a solid being, a me. But it's mostly smoke and mirrors. And we get caught in the illusion of it. So the Buddha is trying to get us to really question, what are we believing in? Because it's the whole problem of avijja, not knowing the true nature of things, moha, to be deluded, is being deluded and not understanding the actual condition that we're in. We create suffering out of it, create problems and difficulties, complications. And the Buddha is giving us an option to free ourselves. And it's actually difficult. It's actually extraordinarily difficult to free ourselves. It's like it's like being in a cage, and after having been in a cage for so long that somebody opens the door and you just don't even take the option to go out of the door. I think there's some caged animals, pets. In zoos and whatnot, I'm sure that this happens, where the cage becomes so familiar that is the world, and as soon as the door is open, then it doesn't even seem an option. Doesn't even seem like it's an option. Or it looks like a frightening option. I wouldn't want to go up that door. Don't know what's up. Never been out there before. So the option then comes, well, I'll just stay in my cage. Which is kind of a safe option. You get food every day. They bring you water, bring you food. Clean it up every once in a while. But it's a life in a cage. And that's the thing, the Buddha's giving us the option to get out of the cage, free ourselves. And it takes effort. One of the well-known talks of Ajahn Chah's. He talks about the keys of meditation. And that's the meditation, or Gunja Bhavana, the Bhavana, the training or the development, mental development. It's more than meditation. But that's the sort of the key to get us out of our cages. So to attend to this developing of the bhavana, attend to the developing of our training, because it is the key that will allow us to really see the world more clearly, see the illusion of self more clearly, the construction. Of the whole edifice more clearly, and then to really, by bringing it into the present moment, to see, well, you know, I can work with that, I can handle that, you know, even something as intimidating as death, you can handle it. Something as intimidating as the relinquishment of particular habits or fears. One can keep working with that in the present moment. And there's a, it doesn't mean it falls away immediately just because one turns. Decides to become aware or start to look at something more clearly. It doesn't fall away immediately, but you start realizing you have the confidence to work with it, to bring the skills of those keys of meditation that unlock the cage of our confinement, cage of our suffering. That bringing it into the present moment and being willing to just keep returning to establishing awareness, establishing the care and attention to the meditation or the, because the mind wants, and watching impermanence, watching change, because when one starts to attend to something like just a fear or a desire or particular sense of certainty, this is the way it really is. This is questioning it and holding it. And it isn't to make it absolutely. To try to create the illusion of certainty, but to actually be willing to be present with something. It's like that holding of the object of attention, the object of mindfulness, the holding of the mindfulness itself. I'd say it's an ancient image. I think it's commentarial, but very early commentaries. I don't think it's in the canon. The way the Buddha taught the image of the holding of the bird. I don't think it's an image the Buddha used. I think it's a very early commentarial. In a sense of the holding of a bird. If you hold it too tight, you crush it. This little bird, delicate little bird. And if you hold it too tight, of course you crush it and kill it. If you hold it too loose, then it just flaps off and flies away. Attending to that holding, how do we hold the meditation? How do we hold it so that we're not crushing the mind in terms of crushing our sense of interest or our sense of kind of assiduousness in practice? Because we can, you know, we worry too much about the practice, or we try too hard, or we trying to force ourselves to conform to some idea of what we think we should be accomplishing or being as meditators or practitioners. You know, we crush the kind of interest and joy in practice. But then, you know, if we hold it too loose, you know, if we're not diligent, if we're not really careful, if we're not really consistent, if we're not really energetic, you know, things get really sloppy and flabby in practice. The mind is, it's not, because it takes it's like the mindfulness that the Buddha says is that we need is like that mindfulness of the person who's carrying that bowl of oil and filled to the brim, with a person walking behind him with a sword, and you're walking through the crowd in a marketplace, and got this brute of a guy behind you with a sword, and if you spill a drop of it, then the sword comes down and cuts your head off. Would that person be mindful of that bowl of oil? Yeah, you'd be very well. That's the kind of mindfulness that one needs. So it's not sort of really sort of warm and fuzzy, really nice mindfulness. it's really, it's just life or death mindfulness. This isn't just sort of, get that mindfulness together in such a nice warm way and make it really something that supports all your sort of sense of well-being. You want to be really on top of everything. So this balance of holding, it's not, it can't be so tight that you're crushing the bird, but it can't be loose and sloppy either. And it really is it's a life and death situation. It's like a Jen Cha thing. Yeah, a moment without mindfulness is a moment of derangement and insanity. 5 moments is five moments of derangement and insanity. It's not a way to live. As we become more mindful and sustain our mindfulness, then we start actually to live as human beings and functioning human beings, sane human beings. To sort of being able to give ourselves that opportunity, that freeing ourselves, getting out of the cage, recognizing that we're actually in a cage. We're in the cage of, and then that creates all these images, perceptions of who we think we are, what the world is. And realize, well, there's a whole other reality. What are we believing in? What should we, you know, what are we, what do we need to see? So reflecting, investigating, using the teachings of the Buddha to give ourselves an opportunity to experience something other than suffering, seeing the way out of suffering. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.